This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. I want you to discover the future of trading with IBKR Desktop, Interactive Brokers' next-generation trading platform. Built from the ground up, IBKR Desktop combines their powerful features with a unique set of groundbreaking trading tools in a streamlined, intuitive interface. With access to over 150 markets, IBKR Desktop puts global stocks, options, futures, currencies, bonds, and funds at your fingertips. IBKR Desktop includes innovative features like multi-sort, which lets you sort data using multiple factors simultaneously, helping you quickly identify trading opportunities, and even the option lattice, which visually highlights key metrics for smarter decisions. And whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, IBKR Desktop redefines what traders can expect from a trading platform. Experience the future of trading today. And whether you're located in the United States, Australia, maybe even Germany, you'll be amazed with the power of IBKR Desktop. Download IBKR Desktop at ibkr.com/desktop. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Well, that was a short week, but there was plenty of action. The breath, it just keeps on getting worse. The debate, what does that mean for markets? And our guest, a good friend, author and banker, former banker, Das, all the way from down under. All this and much more on episode number 876 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello there, and I hope you enjoyed your 4th of July festivities, the fireworks, the food, the hot dogs, the hamburgers, the chicken, the corn on the cob, all the good stuff that we get in the summers. And thanks for being here on this, past 4th of July weekend, I guess. And I'm Andrew Horowitz. I wanted to let you know that. Remind you also that each and every week, I not only do and host this podcast, but also co-host DH Unplugged. And I get together each and every Tuesday with John C. Dvorak. If you don't know him, you got to check it out. It's a great show. Our relationship is just wonderful. And also our repartee, the ability to dissect some of the things that are going on in the news related to finance and markets, I think it's just wonderful. We also play games. We have some things like Close to the Pin, where you get involved with that, could win a bunch of prizes for guessing where a stock is going to be sometime in the future. And we lay it all out for you, as well as pretty much every week, I would say every week, what we do is we have our game of stock picking, John versus me. We come up with some names, reasons, rationale, why we like it, and put it on the list, and you can track that on the web live. I mean, it's just a game, but it's fun. Anyway, aside from that, again, that's DH Unplugged. You can check that out. Well, we had three and a half days of trading. Is that right? Let's see, Monday, Tuesday, half a day Wednesday, not Thursday, and Friday. It's 3.5 days of trading. Last week, light volume, people were pretty much just off the desks, it looked like, and not really caring about what happens. And I don't think it's anything more than we're entering the summer months. And that's just part of the seasonality, just part of what we are conditioned with, that people just take off, especially because, I mean, I'm in the summer all the time. It just gets hotter. It doesn't get hot. It gets hotter down here in South Florida. When you look around the country, though, someone in, I don't know, Wisconsin, someone in New York, someone in Washington State, well, it gets warm for a few months and they want to go out and play and do their thing. And if traders are in those areas, oftentimes what we find is there is a lull in the action. Not as much as we saw back in the maybe 1960s when you were off the desk, so to speak. Well, you were off. Now you got a phone. You could trade. You could rack up millions of dollars of trades in 5 minutes on your phone. So it's not off the desk like it was. However, there's still a mentality that it's this summer. And summertime, you usually see those bigger swings. We haven't seen anything yet, but July and August are here and then into September. And September, being usually one of the hottest months of the year, especially down here, is, well, the beginning of September, at least August into September, past Labor Day. That's sometimes when it gets a little bit, creaky. Markets get a little funky. So on top of that, we're seeing not only a little bit of a slowdown in volume, not terrible, but the bigger issue right now is that the breadth of the market, it stinks, so to speak. It's getting narrower and narrower. We talk about breadth. We talk about the advanced decline line. We talk about the stocks that are pushing markets up. The advanced decline line, the McClellan Oscillator, those are really good indicators to understand what is happening with the general markets. However, there's a big differential. You can't just use the AD or the advanced decline line to understand what's really happening unless you understand what stocks are moving. Because if we just look at the indices, we know, because we've talked about this 1,000 times, we know that the indices are market cap weighted. And as such, just the advanced decline line is really just what, 500 stocks are up and 1,000 are down, or vice versa, somewhere in between. We've seen many days when the markets are up when in fact the AD line or the advanced decliners, the decliners outpace the advancers. And that is because that there's only a few stocks that are leading the market. And that's because of the market cap weighting. Pretty interesting. Now, we know it's been a relatively good year this year so far. And again, we've seen that in the major indices, the NASDAQ 100, the NASDAQ itself. We've seen the S&P 500. A little bit for the Dow, not as much. It's up a little bit. But, tech is supplying all the gusto, and the Momo crowd is helping to push that pretty well. That, I think, is right now, there's no question that we could all say that that's just fact. That's what's going on. But what's also interesting, and did you know this? That there are some sectors, many sectors, not faring so well this year so far. It hasn't been as broad-based and as expanded as we'd like to see. Does it mean it's not happening? No. Does it mean the indexes shouldn't be here? I don't know. They're there. So we're not going to get away from the obvious truth and the facts of what's going on. But we are going to be is a little skeptical. We're going to look at this and say, well, okay, is this going to hold up? And if it doesn't, maybe there'll be a rotation into the other names. For example, small caps, barely up, pretty much flat as of right now for the year, as compared to a 14% increase or an 18% increase NASDAQ and S&P 500. So there's a big differential in what's going on. What does that mean? It doesn't have to mean something. Can it mean something? Yes. It can mean that we have this sinkhole that I've talked about 100 times. It can mean that when this does, when people run out of money and get to the points of valuation that becomes a little bit top heavy, that it all just comes down. Does it mean it collapses? Not really. It corrects. The problem with corrections is they haven't been allowed. They've been semi-outlawed since the stimulus package of 2020 with COVID and then the follow-on with the Fed. The Fed is basically the market's best friend, that no matter what happens, Powell will hang the carrot out there and suggest that there's going to be some kind of rate cut and a softer overall Fed. Now, that could change. How could that change? Well, if we keep on seeing inflationary numbers that are racking the reports on a regular basis. We did see a little bit of a let off of some of that. The steam kind of came out of the inflation discussion this week with some of the employment numbers. We also saw that there was some level of housing. Housing starts down 50%. Multifamily. Multifamily housing starts down 50% on a year-over-year basis, 20% for single family on a year-over-year basis. That's just the starts. We've seen other things also that are cooling off. Finally, housing prices seem to be getting a little bit better. Used car prices are starting to come down a little bit. All this is feeding into the idea that somewhere, somehow, sometime, someday, maybe we're going to see a rate cut. All bets right now are on September. I'm saying that probably December. I'd like to see them let it sit a little bit longer and get beyond the election. Which brings me, it brings me to the election. Brings me to the not-so-presidential debate. The two little children that were on the stage debating, I don't know, golf scores, handicaps, talking about things they said that they didn't say that they said that they didn't say. And the impact of that particular debate. I think it goes without saying, I don't care what side of the aisle that you're on. Biden looks pretty bad from a standpoint of aged, from the standpoint of ability, clear-mindedness. Now, they're going to double down. They've been doing so, trying to say there's nothing, he had a cold, don't worry about it. I mean, I've seen clips from 2019, 2020, when he was debating compared to now. There's a big difference. And back then, I thought he was questionable in terms of age. And Trump, you know what? You got to say, wow, he really held back. He had a couple of zingers in there, but I mean, really didn't, I didn't see too many slams. And I don't know if it's he felt bad for Biden or what it was, but a lot of questions are being asked. A lot of things are swirling around, like what's going to happen? We don't know. We don't know. You know, is Biden going to drop out? Isn't he going to drop out? And if he does or if he doesn't in this not so quote unquote presidential debate from his results there. And again, I didn't see him very presidential, either of them. Marcus is going to try to handicap a few things. And we could probably focus in on because we just talked about it, what's going to happen with inflation? And how is this all going to play out with regard to is one or the other more or less inflationary? Now, for a moment, let's put down the political nature of our being and talk about reality. We know that both are relatively inflationary presidents. Both like stimulus. They like it in different ways. Both are going to probably come to the fore and be, I would say, a force of inflation moving forward. Is one worse than the other? I think that probably if we had to nail it down and really come to a conclusion, we could say that Biden was worse, but Trump is not that far distant behind. He likes to cut taxes. He likes to issue debt. He likes to stimulate. Biden likes to stimulate, give away checks, and just throw money everywhere, regardless of if it's needed or not, it seems. And we know that from the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act. But more importantly, a lot of people are asking about, what about the sectors? What's going to be good? I mean, if Biden's president, let's not go to the whole thing of him bowing out yet, but if Biden's president or if Trump is president, which is better? And we could probably talk about things like, oh, well, if Biden's president, clean energy stocks, EVs, things of that nature. Trump is president, old-fashioned energy, private jails, right? And market's going to try to figure this out. That's what they do. There's no absolutes because we don't know where it's going to go. And if right now you want to say, okay, Trump's got an extraordinary lead right now after that debate, that we're going to start putting money in things like Geo Group, and we're going to put things in like Occidental Petroleum, and we're going to look at all the vast gamut of stocks that are related to the energy sector, even defense for that matter. I mean, fine. But I think we need to have some more time. No need to try to get ahead of things right now. Really, we don't have a clue of what their economic initiative is going to be. Neither of them talked about it in the debate, which is where you think you'd hear about some of this. But they were busy with talking about all sorts of other nonsense. The economic agendas at this point are questionable. We don't know. We know that Trump talked about reducing down some corporate taxes from 21 down to 20. Okay, big deal? Not really. We know that there's a continuation of the discussion about, you know, supplying money for the chips companies. That would be good under Biden. But we don't know. My point here is I wouldn't want to get ahead of this right now. Let's see what the market tells us. That's the play right now. That's a much better way to go. So with that, let's move along. And our guest today is Satyajit Das. He's a former banker and author. He is an internationally respected expert in finance. I've known him for many, many years. He has like almost four decades of experience, and he was very correct in his anticipation of many aspects of the global financial crisis in 2006. Then he proved right and accurate in his warnings about the ineffectiveness of policy response and the risk of low growth and sovereign debt problems like what we saw in Greece and all sorts of problems in the economies of China. In 2014, Bloomberg nominated him as one of the 50 most influential financial thinkers in the world. He's an author of many key reference works and two amazing books. Three. One is Traders, Guns, and Money in 2006, Extreme Money in 2011. And his latest book, which has been rewritten also, again, A Banquet of Consequences. Have we consumed our own future? Very excited to have Das on again. So Das, it's been a while. I'm so happy that you've joined us again. I find you to be very soothing sense of reality. Sometimes not that I love all the things we talk about, but I know that there is a backlog of information that you bring to make sense of all this, because a lot of things that go on in the world these days just don't make a lot of sense, but we just go along with it.
Well, I think, you know, there's a lovely line that Violet Crawley in Downton Abbey has. The truth is neither here nor there. It's the look of the thing that matters. So we live in one of those ages, basically. So, you know, facts and stuff, you know. I have a book, not in finance, but in wildlife out at the moment. And somebody said, why are all these facts in there?
Why? It's so disturbing. I have to get through all these facts to get to the stuff that's interesting.
That's right.
Well, one
that's
of the facts right. that we it's have, strange. One of the facts that is happening right now, and the idea of what is factual versus isn't is this idea of inflation, disinflation, deflation. I think we haven't talked about this, you and I. I think one of the most fascinating things that the Fed does is the wordsmithing they do and how they come up with, maybe they have like a room full of people with, they raise their hand, who thinks this is important, who likes that word. And disinflation came into the discussion, which I think most people thought was really deflation, lower prices. And then it vanished. We're back to inflation now. But let's talk about inflation and when what's going on, how we got there.
I think inflation is a very interesting topic in different ways, because central bankers sort of, you know, they live in a sheltered workshop is the way I would describe it. And they, since about the time of Greenspan and probably starting from Volcker, started to become public figures. And one of the things that they need to do is to have something they can be measured against or something they can beat their chests about. You know, really for the Fed and all the central banks around the world, they think they're in basically the Hunger Games. And they're sort of like comic book superheroes, and they're basically engaged in this Manichean battle against inflation, you know, and they get on and say, you know, we've won, you know, we've beaten these monsters out there. But the reality is, inflation is a rather complex thing, which, you know, I'll be honest with you, I don't understand fully. I understand bits of it. But the first thing I would say about inflation and central bankers is that they actually have been trying to cause inflation since about 2008.
Yeah, exactly.
And they didn't actually succeed till about 2021, when it happened for reasons which actually they had no control over.
No, that's the whole point. Isn't that the funny thing? They didn't really cause inflation. It was all the excess stimulus and the transfer payments and the money directly into the mailboxes and the bank accounts of people that really was the cause of inflation, right, and supply chain issues too. There were some other things too. And probably—
Absolutely.
Dare I say, because they might beat me up years ago for this, is the impact, the long-term impact of tariffs on prices. And the Fed still thinks, though, this is the funniest part of it all, they still think they have control over it.
Oh, you're absolutely right. But let's just back up a stage. One of the most interesting things about it is we sort of intuitively know that inflation is supposed to measure the changes in prices of goods and services. The first question is of what? Because, you know, you consume something, I consume something. It's highly unlikely that we consume exactly the same sort of basket of goods. So it affects different people in different ways. And one crude way of doing it is if you look at basically higher income groups versus lower income groups. In the lower income groups, essentials are more important. So basically there's differences. I always remember in the 1980s when for some mysterious reason I was doing work in emerging markets. There's a finance minister of a Latin American country, I can't remember which one, and they were having hyperinflation. And somebody sort of looked at their inflation figures and said, hang on, you've changed the basket. You know, last time it was these goods, this time it's these goods. And he said, oh, because prices were going up so much, you know, some of those goods got so expensive that nobody could afford them anyway. So
sorry about that. We lost audio for a second. But you were talking about the change in the basket and how things change. There's a funny, you could use this, because I know you like to use money clip, movie clips and things. There was a famous movie by Jerry Lewis said, don't raise the bridge, lower the water, which is essentially what they did, right?
Are you talking about essentially what actually happened with the famous Baltimore thing? They didn't want to move the ship and they wanted to lower the water?
Yeah, well, that too, yeah.
But look, you're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. The measure of inflation is one of the great mysteries of life because, as I was saying, you know, you consume a certain amount of goods, I consume certain things, different people consume different things. And so it's almost impossible to sort of make it uniform. But the problem is that they keep changing the basket of things. And I remember in the 1980s when I was working in emerging markets, the finance minister of a Latin American country, I just can't remember who it was, well, they were having hyperinflation, but we all noticed that they kept changing the basket. And so somebody actually asked the finance minister what was going on. And he said, oh, well, you know, prices are rising so fast that some things are getting so expensive. We took them out of the basket because we figured nobody could afford them anyway. Mm. So it's sort of a strange thing. And in the present environment, the big problem is housing because the owner imputed rents and so forth are fairly subjective. They're not objective measures. Mm-hmm. So we see that. And the central bank has also used different measures because, you know, some focus on the median, some focus on the CPI, some focus on the PPI, some on the GDP price deflator. And the reality is that it's not inflation itself. It's living standards. Because if your prices of things are going up, it's a question of whether you can buy them or not. And it disadvantages certain elements of society, which we all know. If you're on lower incomes and you basically are buying essentials and they keep going up and your wages aren't going up, that's a problem. But the funniest thing about central bankers is I was listening to one central banker, I can't remember which one. They went on about that inflation is coming off, but they're puzzled as to why the population don't seem to understand the great job they've done. And the reality is people really aren't interested in inflation. They're interested in the absolute price level. And even if inflation is low, that doesn't mean the price is coming down.
Right. That was the whole shenanigans they pulled with the disinflation discussion. I do believe they tried to bamboozle the masses.
Oh, yeah. They bamboozle the masses in every which way. I mean, I think Greenspan sort of led the way in terms of, you remember his famous saying that if you have understood me, then you have misunderstood what I'm saying. Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of a weird thing. But the reality is that people actually forget that the problem with inflation is that it creates massive uncertainty around consumption and investment decisions. And one of the things it's doing at the moment is, particularly because almost everybody has a mortgage, as interest rates go up, you have to allocate more of your income to your mortgage repayments. But then fundamentally what happens is you don't spend it on other things. And the whole world fluctuates around consumption and investment. That's a problem.
Well, that assumes you have an adjustable rate mortgage, not a fixed mortgage.
Correct. Yeah. And that is the case in a lot of countries. In US is actually strange. Because it actually has a very high proportion of fixed rate mortgages. That's actually unusual in the world. It's mm-hmm. not the usual in the world. In Australia, for instance, mortgage rates have gone up by between 4% and 5%. And it's destroying consumption here. It's just completely destroying it. And so those types of dynamics. But I think the reality is you have to back up. And I actually have a very strong belief that central bankers talk out of both sides of their mouth. On the one side of the mouth, they're saying, oh, inflation is terrible. We've got to bring it under control. On the other side, they're actually quietly pleased that inflation has gone back to what they would consider to be more normal levels. And the reason for this is they need rising prices. They need it for obviously growth because, you know, if people think prices are going up, they're going to buy things now, not in the future. And it also helps devalue the currency. Mm-hmm. In certain cases, it hasn't worked for the U.S. because higher interest rates have pushed up the U.S. dollar and it's made the U.S. more and more uncompetitive. But the major thing I think it is, it's actually helping them deal with debt. Because in real terms, when you have inflation, particularly if it's above the rates of interest, it just basically reduces the purchasing power of debt. And if that debt is held by foreigners and you can devalue the currency, which Japan is doing very successfully.
Beautiful job, by the way. Beautiful.
They've dropped. I haven't seen the yen at these levels for God knows about 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, what, 20, 30 years?
38 years to be exact.
38 years, isn't that forgotten how long it is? I was a young pup. I was barely out of university in those days. So, you know, it's kind of strange. I can't remember back that far. My concerns were... go on.
I was going to say that this whole inflation thing, how does this work? And I mean, one of the things that we wrote back and forth to each other and discussing, one of the things we're going to talk about is the idea of the war economy. And you wrote a piece recently entitled "The Economics of Attrition Changing Wars." And you talked about, if I may for a moment, say economics underlying the ability to sustain conflict. Western-equipped Ukraine and Israel possess superior conventional firepower, but asymmetrical warfare and low-tech improvisation using cheap drones and missiles could alter the balance, that, like we're seeing with the Houthis, right? So is this somehow working into all this with this whole war economy and the different levels of who can attack and who's not and maybe charging things up a bit?
I think it's two elements to this. Clearly, the security concerns around the world, whether it be actually, you know, real wars or preparation for wars, as is happening in East Asia, people are spending up a lot of money. And this sort of equipment costs not, you know, thousands of dollars, it costs billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of money going in. And if you add to that all the other initiatives around the world, including for climate change and so forth, the spending is up. But coming back to the war economy, I think one of the most interesting things about the war economy is that this is actually quite disproportionate among players. And the example that you used of the Houthis is absolutely true. They're using $30,000 drones, which have to be shot down by missiles costing millions of dollars. And, you know, essentially, it's just completely insane. And the other thing is what they've done, and this goes back to the real economy, is they force people to go around the Cape of Good Hope rather than through the Suez Canal. And that quadruples the cost of a container going from Asia to Europe. So they've changed that. But to give you an idea of how this is working out, let's take just one isolated example, which is the very highly choreographed, you know, Iranian missile attack on Israel, which is like sort of saying, look, we know that you have to retaliate. So the thing we want you to do is retaliate in a way that is highly choreographed so you can say to your people, you've retaliated and we don't have much damage. And we can say, you know, we withstood your attack. And it was just kind of weird. The best way to describe it, it was a bad play. It was a bad piece of theater, is what I would describe it as. Yeah. Nobody believed it, but you know, everybody sort of went through it. But Israel spent about $1.4 billion in munitions and fuel, which is around 6% of its annual budget, to repel what most commentators say is about $30 million of missiles. But actually, the cost is higher because that did include other actors like the UK and the US, which helped repel. So it was like a ratio of 2.35 billion to 30 million. And it's insane. It's absolutely insane. And the West has completely forgotten how they brought down the Soviet Union. They did exactly the same thing. And they did that with Star Wars when Reagan sort of postulated about these strange, you know, lasers in space and so forth, none of which was real and none of it happened. And the Russians panicked and tried to sort of build equivalents and bankrupted in the process. Now it's working in reverse. And the defense, the military industrial complex, which basically Eisenhower wrote about, it's almost insane. You know, people said, well, we're giving Ukraine and Israel and the Far East $90 billion. And I just laughed. I said, that's about 90 Patriot missile batteries, and because they cost $1 billion each. And the essential element of that is those things just chew up resources like there's no tomorrow, because they use very skilled manpower. They also use very, very expensive metals and so forth. And this is just going on. And so that is constantly going to play out because nobody's going to reduce their defense spending in this environment. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I do know is politicians love standing next to tanks and missiles and planes, you know, jumping into planes in their sort of things. I always remember when George Bush went onto the deck of the carrier to pronounce Mission Impossible and showed us that he had rather big testicles.
Mission accomplished, he said. Mission accomplished.
Now, that's right.
So is basically what's happening here is you're saying the war is part, well, there's obviously, you know, horrible things happening, but there's a lot of economic damage and an economic warfare that's going on that's really underlying a lot of what's happening, and it's very asymmetrical, as you've mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is where, with inflation, you've got to go outside of what the central banks are saying and look at the real economy. Hmm. That is what people are buying, where you get those goods from, and how they're supplied. And there's two dynamics here. The war is contributing to demand. Most of the governments basically have lost all control of their bodily functions. You know, they're spending money like there's no tomorrow. I mean, the most interesting thing was between February and now, the U.S. budget deficit has gone from $1.5 trillion to $1.9, and most of that was defense spending. Now, basically, it's a 7% budget deficit. Now, if you add the budget deficit to the trade deficit, we used to have this rule for emerging markets. Once those two numbers added up, went above 10, you basically pronounced you a banana republic. And essentially, the U.S. and quite a few other countries are in that position now. Mm. And it's just insane. So there is a massive amount of demand. But the other thing is the supply side. Because what people forget is for the last probably 30 or 40 years, the emergence of vast production capacity in China and low commodity prices kept goods inflation in check. And now there's longer term factors. And the critical thing goes back to defense. It's sovereignty and security issues. People are onshoring, reshoring, friendshoring, whatever that means. But that basically contradicts the principles of comparative advantage, where we let people who could produce things cheaply produce them, and we just bought them. And we produced what we could sell expensively. But that's now changing. And there's going to be shortages as well of crucial elements. We can see that in raw materials like copper and so forth because of the energy transition. We've got water shortages. We've got energy shortages. And productivity has slowed. And essentially, everybody sort of is now missing the point that the supply side is becoming more and more constrained. And all I hear now is technology, you know, AI. If I hear one more thing about artificial intelligence, I think I'll throw up. Actually, I'm very much in favor of artificial intelligence because I haven't seen much of the humankind in my lifetime. So it might be better. I have no idea whether it'll be better. And I went back and watched 2001, tried to work out whether HAL was actually being sensible or not sensible. So it was kind of interesting to look at. But the point is, all of that is actually quite perverse. It actually doesn't improve productivity. What it does, it's built around selling and advertising. That's all this technology for the last 20 or 30 years has been. And I used to work with a guy who took me to visit a farmer. And, you know, after we discussed technology with him, he looked at us and he said something which I'll never forget. He said, these fiber optic cables of yours, can you send a ton of wheat or iron ore and transport it around the world through one of these? And that to me has always summed up the fact that this whole process of digitization and all the stuff we do, which is neat and cool and all of that sort of stuff, and it's useful in certain context, isn't going to change the world in the way that we think it is. So I think inflation, to get to the end of that, is going to be here at a certain level. And I think the idea of interest rates coming off, because remember, we've had so many pivots, I don't know which way we're facing anymore, to be honest. We keep going around in circles. And basically, you know, at the end of last year, there's going to be lower interest rates. And now through the first half of this year, I've actually switched off. I don't listen to this anymore because it's one day, there's going to be lower rates. No, there's going to be no rates. Yeah. It's going to happen. This is what somebody said. It's an absurd discussion. And I think the thing that people forget is the rates of interest we now have are not abnormal.
Right. They're abnormal for the last 20 years, but they're not abnormal over a much longer.
Exactly. Exactly. So I can't see inflation going away and I can't see interest rates coming down. I mean, you might move from 3% inflation to 2%, but you ain't going to go to zero.
You're not going to go to zero in this environment.
Right. I don't think.
I want to talk about something. I want to talk about de-dollarization. I want to also talk about something that I call selective isolationism, But let's take a quick break and then we'll come back to that. And I want you to listen to this because I want to talk about Interactive Brokers, because there's something interesting here for many of you. Because at Interactive Brokers, you don't have to wait for the markets to open. With around-the-clock trading, you could trade over 10,000 U.S.-listed stocks and ETFs, U.S. equity index options, and U.S. Treasury bonds. Around-the-clock trading helps you stay ahead by allowing you to react instantly to market-moving news and capture more market opportunities. The flexibility allows you to trade on your timetable and invest during local market hours or whenever it's convenient for you. Open an Interactive Brokers account today and discover more trading opportunities around the clock. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Learn more at ibkr.com/aroundtheclock. Back with Das. Now I want to talk about how this all plays into, which we talked about China, and we talked about the big mishap with supply chain, which, by the way, that whole supply chain thing is starting to come back into the discussion again, and the concerns about that. And maybe it's because of the Cape of, you know, the Suez Canal issues and the Houthis and the, you know, moving around from here to there. But one of the things that has been coming up time and time again, you mentioned it, was deglobalization, or at least, you know, people, I call it selective isolationism. Because deglobalization is like everybody's just, you know, kind of just naturally doing their thing. Since Trump, it seems like we want to like push back and be on our own. Since COVID, when the supply chains shut down, we're like, maybe no. Maybe we'll just do it on our own to a degree. So I'd like your thoughts on that. And then talk about the de-dollarization trend that's going on. And does it actually have some legs?
Coming back to... I mean, you're right. We talk about deglobalization. We talk about slow globalization. Sort of, there's all these acronyms that consulting firms with their PowerPoint presentations throw around. But the reality is that there's two dynamics at play. One is what you mentioned, which is security. And I think the COVID-19 pandemic threw up that, you know, most countries can't make vaccines. They can't even make masks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have to have some degree of autonomy in that sense. And obviously the wars and the security tensions around the world have made that much more front of center of mind. And the other thing is, people forget there's a political aspect to this as well. Nothing plays more to political rhetoric than security, national security, homeland security, whatever you like to call it. You know, people like to sort of beat their chests and say, you know, we are protecting you. You know, we are better at doing that than our competitors. So that's very, very important. But the second element of globalization, which is very, very important to focus on, is that we all sort of agree intuitively it went too far. I mean, you just have to look at the U.S. Rust Belt in the Northeast. And essentially, there was a whole bunch of people whose lives were just decimated. I used to live next to a woman from England for many, many years. And her father lost his job in the 1980s in the famous, you remember the miners' strikes in the U.K.
Sure.
Under Margaret Thatcher?
Yeah.
And she lost a job. He lost his job, and he never got another job because in those impoverished towns in Yorkshire, there isn't much else that you can do. And, you know, despite people saying we're going to level up and we're going to bring new high-tech industries, you're not going to make a miner into a coder. I do know.
Okay,
you're not going to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that whole group of people got left behind. And look, I understand their frustration, their anger, and all of us, and me included in that, if anything goes wrong, I like to blame other people.
Uh-huh.
And so basically, they blamed other people. And it went to two things. One was foreigners, and the Chinese were a big front and center because, you know, they took over manufacturing of the world. And on the other side was the elites, you know, and to be honest, you and I benefited from globalization. That's just a fact of life.
Okay.
Yep. We benefited.
Sure.
But other people didn't. And that pushed populist politics, which you see manifested in different ways in different countries. And those tensions mean people moved towards isolationism of some kind. And they vary incredibly in terms of isolationism. And in the case of the US, there's a couple of problems. As an outsider of the US, I can say this. The US suffers from this manifest destiny and exceptionalism syndrome. So now that they find that they're no longer as powerful and as influential in economic and other terms in the world, there is a desire, you know, it's nostalgia. You know, we want to be what we once were. And that's understandable, but it's not helpful. So all of these forces at the same time are pushing. And the most concrete manifestations of that we actually find is what you mentioned, things like tariffs, you know, transfer of technology restrictions, and, you know, exchange of information, exchange of technology in terms of researchers and things working together. And all of that is really not good for the world economy, because all of that exchange, all of that trade is what underpinned the growth from the late 1980s to really about now. And that's the issue. I noticed that certain people are sort of holding up statistics and basically saying, oh, well, you know, Chinese exports haven't gone down, so globalization in this place. I think that misses the point.
Mm-hmm.
That misses the point completely. Yeah. You can't measure it in that way. And this will take decades to unwind. But with these tariff proposals and things that we've seen now from political mouths, I really fear that we're going to go backwards rather than forwards. And the thing is that the concerns that I've mentioned of autonomy and of people left behind are genuine concerns. They have to be dealt with. But we seem to be dealing with them by becoming like North Korea. You know, that doesn't really help us. That doesn't really help anybody.
Doesn't help anybody.
That's the issue.
Yeah.
And that's a sad thing that's happened, I think, particularly in the last 4 or 5 years.
So how does that all tie into the potential of this constant chatter about the dollar's going down? You know, they're going to need an alternative currency for the world. Right now, the dollar is you know, you could think of many people talking about this for years, by the way, that it's going to break. It's going to go. I mean, there was always bets on currencies around the world. But it never seems to be the problem that people make it out to be. The only thing I could tell you is this. Very quietly, the dollar has been decimated over the last however many years. Now, not against the yen and all that, but still, from the buying power of what we have, that's inflation, by the way, and how we look back 10 years ago and something was, you know, $100,000 for a house and now it's $500,000 for a house. Well, that's because the dollar is worth less domestically. Is there a chance that something is going to come in and replace the dollar as the global reserve currency?
You know how in the world there are gold bugs?
Yes.
No matter what the gold price is, they want to buy gold. You know, they always have this beautiful story of why you should buy gold, whether it's $2,000 or $20. It doesn't make any difference. They want to do that. And the people who talk about the demise of the dollar are in a similar club. You know, for them, the dollar is always going to be replaced by something else. But there's a few facts which you need to be very careful about. One is the dollar's position is very dominant in things like trade, in payments, and reserves. And if you look around the world, 96% of trades in the Americas is dollar-based, 74% in Asia-Pacific. And if you look at the rest of the world, it's about 80%. It's only in Europe where the euro obviously dominates. It's less than in first place. About 60% of international foreign loans, etc., are in dollars. And in terms of foreign exchange transaction, if you take the dollar as one side, it's 90%, and 60% of reserves are in US dollars. So that is completely disproportionate to the size of the US, which is about give or take a quarter of the global economy. So it's actually not, if you look at the headline figures, a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But the point that you just made is the crucial point. People will continue to hold dollars, particularly as a reserve currency, if they believe it's going to be a good, safe store of value. And this is where the problem is now getting worse and worse and worse, because the US has completely incontinent fiscal and monetary policies. And what that's done is, as you pointed out, is reduced the long-term purchasing power of the US dollar. And since 1972, against gold, it's fallen by 99%. And if you check stake what you're talking about, real things like houses, goods and services, it's fallen by 90%. But that's one part of the equation. And then it becomes, well, if you don't put it in dollars, where do we put it? And the problem is there ain't too many other places. Mm-hmm. But the other issue, I think, is the crucial one that people miss. American policymakers who, I don't know where they're trained and what they think, and more to the point, what they drink. But they basically sometimes have go insane. There's a very famous line from Euripides, the Greek playwright, those whom the gods wish to destroy, they first make mad. Mm. And American policymakers fit that bill, because the essential element that they've now introduced into the mix, which wasn't there before, was they've started to weaponize the dollar in different ways, mainly to achieve political, not economic objectives. So, for instance, you actually have this thing after the Ukraine conflict started to exclude certain entities from the international payment system like SWIFT, which, by the way, isn't a US system. It's actually based in Brussels. So, you know, you're trying to get other people to do your bidding. But where it's really problematic is in two areas. One is what we call secondary sanctions. So let me give you an example. I'm an Australian company doing business with China. And let's say we make payments in US dollars. Now, under US law now, if the person I'm dealing with is sanctioned by the US and I pay them in US dollars, which is legal in both China and Australia, but the US dollars obviously flow through the US banking system, I am actually in breach of US sanctions. And if I land in the US, I can be given an orange suit and locked up.
Mm.
That's just insane. That's just insane, because the only nexus I have to the US is that the dollars have flowed through the banking system. And what that has happened is, and I've seen this with businesses who now don't want to deal with certain people around the world because of this threat, whether it's real or not. And the second one is basically asset seizures, which, as everybody knows, happened after the Ukraine war started, where the US and its allies have frozen $300 billion of Russian central bank dollar holdings. By the way, the funny thing that the mainstream press seems to miss is the Russians actually have the capacity to seize more than that in real assets of US businesses in Russia.
Well, they did that. So, McDonald's is no longer, they did that already.
Yeah, some of them they've done, but they could do more. Mm-hmm. They could do much more if they wanted to. They've left some of the businesses to operate. But essentially what the US and the allies are doing is seizing these assets, and they're going to use some of the income to help Ukraine and do all sorts of things. But the real problem here is if you selectively cancel the holding of US dollars, which is what you're de facto doing here, the problem here is that it's actually, number one, in my view, it's a selective default on US government obligations. Remember, dollars are US government obligations.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is, if I was now Saudi Arabia or China or Japan or Taiwan or Korea or anybody else holding US dollar reserves, what would I be thinking? Should I be holding US dollars? Because they can be taken away.
If they can be confiscated at will, that's a concern.
That's right. And so this is what's come into the equation. And I think what the US policymakers are now relying on is, there's an old line about a Mercedes-Benz. You buy a Mercedes-Benz and you drive it out of the lot, and it sort of goes fine for about 4 or 5 miles and then suddenly stops, and you open the hood and you find there's no engine. There's a rubber band that's being sort of wound up. And, you know, you go take it back to the dealer to have it towed back to the dealer and say, what's that? He says, well, it runs on reputation. You know, it doesn't run with a motor. It runs on reputation. And the US dollar is running on reputation.
Right. It's all a giant game of confidence. I don't mean a con game.
Correct.
But it's a confidence game. In God we trust, in the US we trust, and that's what it is. Now, the good news is that that confidence has really not broken yet. As a matter of fact, we see the dollar being as strong compared to other currencies around the world for a lot of different reasons, but still that confidence that the backing of the US. The question is, how much debt do we have to encumber in the U.S. So I guess to be a point that it's an issue. We used to laugh at the countries that was like, oh, look at their debt to GDP ratio. Oh, we're look at us. No, we're not there. We're right where they were before.
And you're absolutely correct. The dollarization issue and the debt issue is linked. Because the U.S. has been able to finance its deficits easily because everybody has to hold dollars as a reserve asset. So it makes it life easier. So, you know, the petrostates and all the surplus countries hold dollars. But this is where it's going to get very interesting because I think it's changing. And it'll be a slow process. This takes generations to do. But basically what's going to happen is certainly people have introduced bilateral trade arrangements in different currencies. But the most interesting thing to me is China has reduced its U.S. Treasury holdings to below $800 billion, which is down about 40% from a decade. And in my conversations with people around the world, all the official sovereign wealth funds, the central banks, want to reduce their dollar holdings. Mm. Now, that means two things. One, reducing means they're not going to buy any more, but they're going to also, when things mature, obviously not roll into dollars. And then the question is, what are they going to buy?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? What are they buying?
And they're buying gold, but they're moving into real assets. I mean, one of the things that people often don't focus on is people like these sovereign wealth funds buying sporting teams and other franchises around the world and creating entire industries, rightly or wrongly, some of these will be disastrous, but they're trying to do that is to diversify away from the dollar. But I think that's a slow process. It took the pound, two world wars and about 80 years to die as a reserve currency. So it's not going to happen quickly, but I think there's a subtle other change, which is linked to some of the things we were talking about before, which is this deglobalization or the isolationism. Now, if you actually back up from our discussion and say, well, why do you need a trading and reserve currency anyway? Mm-hmm. It's because there are imbalances. So the U.S. basically and China have a terribly imbalanced trade relationship with the U.S. importing more than it exports. So what does that mean? Well, China, if we settle in U.S. dollars, ends up with surplus U.S. dollars that they've got to do something with. And if we redenominate that in Chinese yuan, then the U.S. has to be able to finance the yuan to pay them. Now, what is actually, I think, going to happen, and it's a slow, painful process, but it'll be a disastrous one, like the 1930s and the Smoot-Hawley trade things, is what we're talking about with trade restrictions and so forth. So gradually over time, these trade imbalances will get less and less. And this has two implications. One is you won't need a reserve currency necessarily in the same way. And on the second side, it'll damage global capital flows. And this won't happen in a very simple way, but what will happen is many countries will try to balance their trade with others or within blocks. And the classic example of that is the euro. Because if you look at euro, there's large surplus countries and large deficit countries. But if you take the euro block as a whole, their trade is much more in balance than people would assume. So you don't really need to have reserve currencies or trading currencies. And I think that's going to happen. So you were talking earlier about isolationism. And I think what the world is now moving towards, regrettably, is a bilateral or multilateral autarky, which is self-sufficient economies to a large extent. And this is going to change the growth trajectories and the development trajectories. And I think that's going to be gradually something that happens. But I think what for the U.S. the implication is, if that happens, the loss of the dollar's status as a reserve currency will make it much harder for them to fund budget and trade deficits. Dollar interest rates will have to rise and the currency devalue. And the role of its capital markets and financial institutions will obviously not be helped. So for the moment, I don't think de-dollarization is as obvious a threat as it is. But I think over time, you'll start to see this manifest itself. And the one thing in financial markets people always forget is once this idea gets into somebody's head, they will immediately present value that back to today. Mm-hmm. And that adjustment will be very quick.
Yeah.
And that is what is going to happen in my view. We'll wait and see, but I'm just hoping it doesn't happen in my lifetime.
You know, one thing that you mentioned here, which is, I think, a very, very subtle discussion that you had that most people don't recognize, is that sovereign wealth funds have a substantial amount of money. We have no idea how much and how impactful, the sovereign wealth fund, whether it's Japan, whether it's, you know, Netherlands, it's Norway, whether it's pick your poison, okay? And then we're not talking about small amounts, are actually plunking money into the U.S. stock market, which could be the conversion factor why the dollar is rising on top of it to buy assets in dollars, and why the condition of the stock market is it never goes down.
I think that's a very part of it. And I'll give you a very good example of that, the Swiss National Bank.
Yeah.
Because to keep the Swiss franc value at ranges that it wants to, has been a big buyer of U.S. stocks. And because they don't want to discriminate, they tend to buy ETFs, or they've bought heavily into tech ETFs and so forth. And that's created enormous buying pressure. But that's absolutely the first thing. And the second thing is they're buying these companies because they're trying to diversify away from government debt. And what they're trying to do is buy real cash flows. And that's been underpinning a lot of the performance of certain stock markets. That's absolutely no doubt about that.
And they can create, the thing that also we have to understand is that they have the ability to essentially create money, not that all of them will, but they can if they needed it. And therefore they have an unlimited stash to buy things. Indeed. A very long holding time.
And I think that's the second point is the really important one. They have very long holding periods because they don't trade in and out every day. They just basically hold for the long term. And I think these are going to be the fascinating things that play out slowly. And I think, you know, people at the moment are concerned about whether NVIDIA goes up 5% in a day or 5% in a week. But the reality is there's a structural change going on. And I think we're at a period of time, which is really quite interesting. It's like a big hinge. It's like an end of empires where the US empire's role in the global economy is changing. And I don't exactly know how that's going to end up. But in that period of change, lots of dynamics will play out. And the important thing here, I think, is to keep your eye on the longer term, not on the short term. Mm. Because the short term is almost totally unpredictable.
I feel like this is the REM song, The End of the World as We Know It.
Look, it is the end of the world, but I think there's another song which is pretty good, which is Pink Floyd. We just two lost souls swimming in a fish bowl year after year, running around the same old ground. What have we found? The same old fears.
Yep, same old stuff right around. Das, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you for spending time with us once again on the show, and we'll direct people how to buy your books and all the other stuff that you have available. Thank you so much for being here and being a good friend for the last decade.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Best of luck.
Thanks. And that's going to wrap up this post-Independence Day podcast, The Disciplined Investor. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You know, and if you want to work with us, if you want to see what we do, how we manage money for other people just like you, where we do things like our TDI Managed Growth Strategy, which is a really interesting long-short strategy for those of you that want to sort of look at both sides of the markets. And also on top of that, we have things like Investology for people with smaller amounts of money that want to start out, or our global allocations. Bottom line, there's something for you there. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Get in touch with me. Let's take a look at your portfolio. Let's do a portfolio review, why don't we? Send me over your stuff. We'll take a look at it. We'll say, hey, look, this is fine. You're doing great. Don't worry about it. Or here's some ways to improve it. Thanks for joining me this week and every week. I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida
and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.